I do recall even something when I was first starting off and reading, and I think it was some sort of review or editorial type piece in Cell about doing this with antibiotics too. You know, we don't need the rabbits anymore, and we can do this all synthetically, and now we can just kind of do these kind of, you know, change the one thing, and so we can just do a whole series of antibiotics on one sort of thing with just the minor changes, and we can just have them ready to generate, you know, mm-hmm. enough whenever we need it, and we can just have a library after library or stock after stock of all these, you know, we can just, it doesn't matter, we'll just, you know, synthesize it and make it. And this is all just down the road, and the person set forth kind of the three or four general rules about making these. I can't remember who it was. I think it was somebody at Scripps, but mm-hmm. I remember being because, like I said, this was like 2 weeks into, you know, just kind of like realizing I was in big trouble with having to learn.
So they were saying you didn't need design, or that design would be helpful.
This guy did, or I was saying? Oh, no, he was saying that this was, you know, that this was not just about drugs, but about antibiotics even, right, yeah, that it was completely going to be removed from the even if you will, he certainly didn't use the non-intelligent way of getting the bunny, you know, and doing the process kind of manually. It was just a matter of punching, well, perhaps your image, is accurate of just a bunch of monkey typewriters. You know, okay, well, synthesize this one. And he was talking about randomness in the sense of mm-hmm. you just synthesize, you know, you could just plug in finally and change it if somebody thinks, oh, well, this will work. It seemed rather hit or miss to me, but it's also at the same time was amazing to me that they were at this point, if you will, or he was convinced they were at this point of simply, this is, I mean, I guess the idea was somebody's sick. It seems like they've got, okay, we need an antibiotic to, okay, mm-hmm. so we just analyze the virus, and then we'll punch in the numbers into the computer, and we'll get enough of this antibiotic, and it should fight this virus.
Yeah, I mean, on a social level, this is a key point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people argue, for example, that the reason that you need biological diversity in the world,
mm-hmm.
say, save the rainforest,
right,
is that there are compounds out there that could be useful drugs.
Well, and the synthesis of those compounds, we need to kind of to know what they are like first or naturally or something.
Mm-hmm. So that's one sort of benefit. In addition to sort of ecological arguments, there's this sort of
Taxol being, I guess, the kind of the
But
the epitome, because of its, you know, its scarcity and it's
also very complicated, right? And so, I mean, Taxol is an example where I think the effort now is to clone the genes for all the proteins that are involved in the biosynthesis of Taxol.
And hasn't some lab actually got some either like Taxol precursor synthesized or something, or something that came close, or my God, whatever.
But I don't know, the idea that is sort of taking hold is, well, maybe we don't need all this because we can eventually just design what we need and synthesize
it. Oh, I see, kind of the opposite side of that.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, that randomness has a huge benefit. If you can screen lots of things rapidly, then you find out things you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that certainly, I could say, motivates lots of my work. Certainly, it's obvious in my postdoc, where what we started with was a collection of random mutations in a protein that all made the protein less strong. And so, without any preconceptions, we went and looked and found, so this is what makes the protein hold together. You know, but if we had preconceptions and used exclusively site-directed mutagenesis to change one thing after another, we might have missed the pattern, and we certainly, you know, would have taken a lot longer to get to this issue of what's important. And the site-directed mutagenesis was really there just to find out, to ask specific questions about very specific sites, and really not to ask the general question, what stabilizes proteins.
Sure. But that's, so, you know, as you say, that's instructive into that question, right? The more general question of what stabilizes proteins is a more specific look at a particular protein and getting it to, I mean, getting a look at it in a kind of a directed way.
So, I think if you get the false impression that you know too much, then you'll miss, you know, learning what's new.
Okay.
And so, it'll be interesting to see what happens when people decide, you know, when corporations decide that all they need is a structure, they'll be able to find new drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may be that means that they'll completely miss compounds that don't actually act through the mechanism that was proposed, that they have thought about ahead of time.
I mean, if you're going to completely rely on randoms, you're going to have to do an awful lot of missing before you hit, right? Whereas...
Well, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at drug discovery, it's 10,000 misses and a hit, you know.
Yeah. Do you think nature's that way, too? I mean, or do you give it some sort of teleological or Leibnizian advantages? In other words, that a protein folds a certain way or is not completely as stable as you can make it in the lab because it may need to... it knows, if you will, that it may need to be more flexible and less stable. In other words, entropy is kind of playing an intelligent role in a situation. Or, you know, natural selection is just, you know, it is the best possible situation because it's random. In other words, it doesn't care whether it... The humanoid walks on it's bipedal or you know walks on all fours or moves on all fours. It just so happens that you know the random events of let's say you know.
Well, again, the randomness doesn't eliminate history because there hasn't been time and there will not be time to try all possibilities of arrangements of you know amino acids even in a protein, let alone ways to make the world. Maybe to answer your question more specifically, I think in the review I wrote a little bit about that either there's no selection or for the most stable proteins or there's an active selection against them. And so the active selection against them is of the type that you've mentioned, that the molecules have to be flexible to function, they have to be flexible to evolve, they have to be flexible to be degraded inside the cell when you don't want them to hang around or when they're not useful, and a completely rigid protein, yes, it would be completely stable, and that obviously isn't the most functional state.
And of course, we've moved totally into murky areas. And like I said, does one want to attach a teleology to all this? And can we almost escape using teleological language to describe what we're describing? And we don't need to kind of, I realize we're not, you know, Ernst Mayr and and Wilson sitting at the Harvard Museum for Comparative Zoology or whatever it is writing there. Polemical books about these issues, but
no, these things do have implications for even practical design issues.
And what gets funded in a sense, I suppose, if you convince the Congress people and whatnot, right? I mean, or the people who have the ear of the people who you know represent the taxpayer. It's a very layered situation, I realize. But yeah, no, I think they do. These issues always have some sort of more immediate
engineering
effect than people want to think about. And I also find them just interesting. And to ask you guys about these things, you know, like, what do you think? You know, it's an indirect way of asking, you know, like, what do you think about God or something, you know, I suppose. And I don't mean that in a trivial or silly way. I mean, people have, you know, this is how we kind of make our own world, I guess, have some structure, if you will, and some stability, is to have certain beliefs and ideas, and we base them on what we know. Well, I guess I am, in a way, kind of sneakily trying to get at some of that, too, from you.
I guess I would, you know, add maybe a darker side of this, which is, you know, what is happening in science now in the sense of the demand that work be immediately practical. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very different from Barbara McClintock or Max Perutz, who just wanted to know what a protein looked like or what is the genetics of maize, you know.
And what was the kind of the atmosphere in which, I mean, with Barbara McClintock, perhaps that's clear. I mean, the atmosphere, the situation, the circumstances in which she found herself. I mean, I think they were rare, yes, and unique almost, but again, they're sort of obvious, whereas maybe with the Max Perutz situation, it's a little more difficult to see. I mean, here's somebody who held a teaching job and a research job for 34 years without, you know, he published left and right, don't get me wrong, a very productive, prolific career, but the answer, the result, as we might want to term it now, the applicability of his work took 34 years to find out, and the kind of the answer was no. It doesn't answer all these questions, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, in that sense, it was disappointing, but I think I'm also saying that there isn't much scholarship left
like that
in the world. Yeah. You know, the funding agencies want to cure cancer, mm-hmm. and it's not that they want to know about X, you know.
Max Perutz would have had a hard time, right? Don't you think? His attitude, I mean, just
sure.
the
oh, yeah.
way he worked and operated today, yeah. you know, he might not even get a Peace Scholarship.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it's not to say that there wasn't directed research before. I mean, you know, even work on coil coils was funded by the Wool Board because keratin has a coil coil in it, you know, and things like that. And they wanted to know the properties of wool.
And a lot of people came to Perutz and sent him samples of his stuff because, you know, they wanted to.
Yeah.
They wanted some answers about stuff. And he was certainly, he was helping people or collaborating with people who had very practical ends in mind. But
it's interesting, the universities, you know, have much more become vocational schools, pre-medical, pre-something.
You know, I've actually, and I was shocked at first, and I think I came through in some of my earlier interviews. It took me a whole long time, and even, you know, I look at people at UCSD, or well, there is a medical school there, but, you know, Berkeley had, you can't be in a medical school here, you know? You can't be, there is no medical school here, and so if you're doing academic biology at Berkeley, you're doing it in, you know, devoid of that professional aspects, the vocational aspects, supposedly. And yet, it took me a long time to realize, boy, of all the fields, it's the biologists who are not, for instance, teaching anymore. They're simply not having contact with undergraduates. I mean, and I've had people tell me, well, why should I? You know, I was trained to run a lab, not teach a class of, you know, 20-year-olds the basics of biology. Mm-hmm.
I don't think you'll find that in this department.
No, I mean, you have to teach it, right? Yeah. I mean, you are, I assume. Yeah. That's maybe something we should cover at least briefly, is some sense of what your teaching duties are and who you do teach, because, again, you're not teaching those two lectures in the, you know, the oncology section to the med students as your teaching duties, because they don't exist here.
Well, I was in a med school in Utah, but,
right.
you know, I made
an effort.
Tacit deal with the department chairman that if they ever asked me to teach the med students, I'd quit.
So you taught undergrads at Utah?
Undergrads and graduate students, mm-hmm. yeah.
In a kind of traditional, like...
Undergraduate biochemistry and protein chemistry for graduate students.
Okay, so the protein chemistry was for straight-up PhD chemistry students.
Right.
Who were in the chemistry department and not in the biochemistry department or physiological chemistry?
Well, we had an unusual situation where five departments had a joint graduate program, so it's people from all over campus. Right.
Including maybe some people in the medical school by getting a PhD.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Their affiliation was first and foremost with the medical school. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, the initial association was with this program, an interdisciplinary program, mm-hmm. and it was only after they completed the core curriculum that the students would choose a department.
Oh, okay. That is unique,
but
right?
The faculty came from all these different departments, and the students would have access to all the departments that the faculty, mm-hmm. contributing faculty came from.
And the biochem course for undergrads was the biochem course for major. I mean, for biochem or chemistry majors or bio. Yeah,
exactly. It was
the pre-meds.
Yeah, it was jointly offered by the chemistry and biology departments.
And it was the, I mean, usually it's either organic chem or inorganic chem, right, that is the killer class. But biochem is used sometimes, too, as the second gate, if you will, the second gated ion channel, right, to let the students through or not.
Yep.
Were you kind of, I mean, is that how you, was it a tough course that you taught, or is it a...
I taught a tough course, yeah.
Okay. Because you were asked to make it tough, or because you believe, you know, you kind of see that as a good place for anybody, PhD, MD, you know, MD potential, you know, potentially an MD or a PhD student to kind of cut their teeth on work, or just because you like a serious group of students and you want the other 20 to please turn around and go out the door when they realize how tough it's going to be, or... you like seeing somebody kind of come in unformed and leave with a real...
No, it was just that I liked what I wanted to teach at a level which I find useful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't that I just sort of ignored the people that were having problems. I mean, I would definitely spend time and give a lot of attention to people who were having difficulty, but I don't think it's useful to water material down to make it so accessible that you can understand biochemistry without any work. I mean, not to say that you should deliberately make it hard or boring or
whatever. I wasn't meaning to make that, but, to make it sound but in any way like
yeah, that. Yeah, I mean, I think there are subtleties to this that shouldn't be ignored.
And require some
thought.
Real hard work.
And, you know, questions like, here's the story. How do people know the story? What's missing from the story? You know?
Can you take a critical look at the story?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have anything to add or criticize about it, even in some critical thinking? I don't know, what the quality or level of the students are in a place like the University of Utah. My own experience at a place like UCLA is probably pretty indicative, though, right? I mean, it's a large public institution, so you get really everything.
Public state university.
From the most brilliant to the, you know, to the least brilliant.
Yeah, really, actually, some wonderful students. Enthusiastic.
Serious. I mean, they're kind serious. Of like you were when you were an undergrad chem major and
Santa
kind of
Cruz.
Looking for the... The good stuff, if you will.
Yeah, you know, thoughtful. I had good undergraduates in my lab, for example, and many of them came from my course.
You know, and more. You're talking plural, more than one at a time.
Oh yeah.
Because a lot of people view that as a responsibility they like to take on. Because actually, I don't know if I can think of one of you who hasn't had some didn't find themselves in a lab, you know, early on, in a sense,
sure.
And that has a lot to do with why you're, doing what you're doing today. And,
yeah.
But they saw themselves as more of a... You want to answer that?
Yeah.
I was in the middle of asking you about, I'm discussing the quality of students. I don't remember.
But we were... I was going to go on kind of, I guess, and ask if they're... It was about people in your lab. That people had seen themselves as kind of... that what they were getting was much more than what they were giving to a lab, in the sense of even washing glass, you know what I mean? That this was what the culture of science, at least in this country, was doing to perpetuate itself. In other words, was bringing in somebody of an undergraduate level without any experience and exposing them to something because they were interested in it. And this was the way one, kind of kept the science going, was this... through this exposure. And I'm wondering, do you take the same kind of view that introducing undergraduates into your lab was as much or was more of a thing for them to be exposed to science in the hopes that they would go on to become, good scientists than the fact that, they were even skilled labor technicians, right,
yeah.
Who were turning out really, really, really high quality or fast or something like that. Work for almost no, pay. Because certainly, that seems the typical thing is you don't work
You don't get paid during the year. You get credit during the summer. You get paid, oh, about $3 an hour. So, I mean, it works both ways, right? They do a little bit of sacrificing, too. And you did it a lot. I mean, it's something it sounds like.
I had really good undergrads. Okay. And you know, Julie Clem and Eric Bertelsen, Nick Benvenue, boy.
So in other words, you're almost kind of talking about these people were what your lab was in the beginning or something. I mean, you know, when you're starting up, they're like so important.
They made important contributions. Okay. And, you know, like Julie worked on three projects in my lab.
She's the first author on papers, right?
You know, all of them worked. Actually, she worked on four projects and three of them worked. And
You said the one that she worked really hard. We already went through the one that, you mean, quote, didn't work, but she said you didn't ascribe any kind of problems to the person.
To her, no. And, she's the first author on a biochemistry paper. She's the second author on the leucine zipper paper. And some of her work is still unpublished, but it certainly is.
And it was all done at an undergraduate level. I mean, she didn't continue on as a grad student in your department or anything like that.
Well, I think she stayed for the summer and fall after she finished.
And now she's
a grad student at MIT.
Oh, and she was, okay, you've mentioned that the class still goes on, the logic and methods class that you, and Charlie Zucker and Hillary Nelson and even David Julius at least had some notion of it. I mean, as an undergrad, I guess they wouldn't let him in, but
no.
He knew it went on.
What the lab gets out of it is, you know, a certain freshness and a certain vitality and energy and life and asking the basic questions again, and connecting them to Kafka and whatever it is, you know.
You require all your undergraduates to have a good grounding in modern European lit, right?
Well, no, but they haven't gone through this incredible narrowing process that, you know, when you start graduate school, I described to you. But, you know, even compared to my postdoc, my graduate time was much more creative, you know.
Just, really?
Oh, okay, yeah. So I mean, we played music, and my housemates played music, and wrote poetry, and made things, and one of my housemates was a painter, and et cetera. And then, you know, you start your postdoc, and I'm playing less music, I didn't write any poetry, I mean, it just goes on. And, you know, my friends are just doing less and less. That's just sort of raw creativity or craft or something, and just more and more that's related to the job.
Do you think that you know, you've expressed already, I think on tape and then certainly off tape, some ambivalence about where you've come, you know, and here you are at Berkeley, and you know, and that some of the responsibilities that come with it, you've also kind of expressed the opposite ambivalence. You used to be really shy, and you hated giving talks and papers and having to be that kind of public persona type thing. And now that you do it, you realize that, of course, you know, if you can get up and give a good talk about the work that your lab does, that's, you know, important. People are engaged in that, motivated by that, to ask you questions, to get you. I mean, that's what science is about, in a sense, or how it gets communicated and furthered. So, you know, you kind of think that the ambivalence runs both ways, right? What a sacrifice I've made in a sense of, you know, narrowed my life, but at the same time, you know, what a good amount of interesting science I've been able to accomplish within that, perhaps that, you know, the requirements of being narrowly focused. And I guess maybe this is a good time to ask about, you know, I mean, to a certain extent it's a sacrifice, right? And I don't mean, okay, you could be an MD or work for a biotech firm and make lots of money, more than you're making now. I don't mean that kind of sacrifice. I meant, you know, of like maybe playing music or still playing a musical instrument or having hiked a lot more and camped a lot more in places you'd like to go hiking and camping. And is that, I mean, it's a pretty recent thing where you, I suppose, moving from Salt Lake to Berkeley is kind of, going from one foot in the water to putting both feet in the water?
No, not at all, not at all.
No, that was still there.
There isn't that, oh yeah.
Okay.
God, it's the whole field. It doesn't relate to whether you're at Salt Lake or whether you're at Berkeley. I mean,
but if you were at Oberlin, I guess I do see. Okay, I didn't mean to put Salt Lake, and I mean you're right. It's a medical, you know, it's a big.
Yeah, it's a serious research.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply otherwise.
Yeah, I mean people are going crazy at how much you have to focus and how dogged you have to be, and you know, how hard the work is with uncertain funding and. Not much recognition sometimes, you know.
Beyond a smaller circle of kind of, like, you know, colleagues in the same field or that sort of thing? Or
yeah, or, you know, just what is it that you give up to do it? And the standards are of accomplishment, you know, certainly you get more done by being dogged and being persistent and putting in the hours and definitely you get more done, and there are people obviously willing to do this, and so you've got you have a choice as an individual, you know, do you do what it takes to be at the head of the field or not, you know, and when funding is very uncertain, if you slip a little bit, does that mean you're out of the box completely, or you know, how hard do people really have to work? And, you know, when I look at my colleagues, assistant professors, junior faculty, associate professors even, just the number of, sheer number of hours and the, you know, culture of in some places, you know, thankfully not Utah, but in some places, people who have children are under suspicion, you know, they're commitment and to the field is under suspicion. You're having a child. I mean, this is going to take a lot of time, you know.
And you certainly aren't going to take the time off to. And I don't mean. I mean, I can imagine some father saying, "Oh, by the way, I'm taking a year sabbatical, and not to go do a sabbatical in so and so's lab, but to sit at home and you know, vacuum and raise a child."
Well,
for
I don't know. People I think maybe don't do that so much anymore. But I mean, I would say that. We're still suffering from a model in which male faculty took advantage of their wives, who in the wives raised the kids,
or they worked in their lab for as research
assistants. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, as a kind of a historical interesting.
It's a historical thing, and so science in this country is still, you know, fighting.
And it seems this. I mean, I still believe. I get the sense that. You know, in England, they don't. They still take tea time, right? I mean, and I may be exact. I mean, you were there.
They do.
Work 50 hours a week and not 80, you know. And they sure, they come in on Saturday afternoon, but just to, I mean, it still is it's a more humane, it seems very much an American thing. A conversation I had with some Pew scholar on a, you know, it's on tape, the notion of, you have to do 80 hours a week, and you have to never stop because you won't be a good scientist and you won't get funded. And I suggested it was the peer review system because, of course, all the people who were getting funded who were sitting on review boards who were in the top of their field were also the ones who were workaholics and were working 80 hours a week. And, of course, the system would perpetuate itself. It wasn't because it was the only way it could be done. It was because the people who were at the top of the heap are working out hard and are willing to kind of perpetuate it. And they thought this was wrong. They just thought that's the only way good science gets done. That the English sit around thinking too much anyway, and they don't get as their work's not as good. they may have some great ideas here and there, but the work's just not as good. And I was wondering if you kind of had maybe you've kind of drawn a picture that's like that.
I mean, there are exceptions to that, obviously, but I certainly feel that way.
But and I would ask even kind of, you know, how many hours do you put in a week here now that you're kind of settled here? At Berkeley with tenure.
no comment. Okay. I mean, I could say that, you know, before I left Salt Lake, I was working till midnight virtually every night. Or
seven?
Beyond.
It's 5 days. We're talking 5 days a week, that kind of midnight work, and then you were in on the weekends, maybe, let's say, less.
No, I usually worked every day.
So you were in the...
Either worked or didn't work, you know, like I'd go skiing, or I'd go for a hike, or I'd go out of town, you know. But if I was in town, I didn't, like, sit home and read a novel on a weekend.
And your wife is still speaking to you and all?
Well, yeah.
Okay. She appreciates it, certainly.
Well, this is a problem. I mean, this is about the balancing act, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we had times that were pretty bad. I mean, I don't mean bad in terms of relationship, just hard to get through.
Right, where you were just working too much. And
where I was just working too much.
The strain on the...
Yeah, and, you know, we solved it by doing things together and going places and skiing,
in other words,
and whatever.
The time, you know? it's kind of like the joke about quality time, but, in other words, you just had to schedule sort of situations where the rest, where the work or the lab was just kind of completely out of the way, or...
Just ignore.
Hi, honey, I'm home
just,
for
dinner.
Yeah,
exactly.
It didn't work like that. It had to be next Thursday, you know, evening, or, you know, we'll go out to the movies or go dance or whatever it is one does when one, you know, has some time.
Well, I mean, also Julie made lots of friends in Salt Lake, and so that took some pressure off.
She's not
our relationship.
Waiting at home, right. She's not waiting at home
exactly.
With the three kids. Sort of situation. I realize, and I didn't mean to imply that she's, you know, she works an 8-hour day, goes home and twiddles her thumbs until you get home at midnight.
Well, I mean, she's also very conscientious, so she worked pretty hard in the lab, so that helped, in the lab that she worked in.
Right.
And then she had lots of friends, and, I mean, I'm not saying that we didn't spend any time together, but, you know, there were times when it got out of hand, that's for sure.
But also there's perhaps this notion on her part and your part of an understanding about the mechanics of running a lab, and whereas your mother might go, you shouldn't be doing that, Sonny, you know, it's not good for the thing, that you and Julie had a situation worked out pretty well or whatever, that some of these pressures are
mm-hmm.
are dealt with in an adequate fashion. Are you working less here? I mean,
definitely.
Okay. and that's not just because things aren't in full swing or something, that's just because you've time that you can not work till midnight every night. Maybe just 3 nights.
Why am I working less?
because
I'm burnt, you know.
Some kid keeps coming by with some guy
with a tape recorder. Yeah. And why am I working less? Definitely have more people in the lab.
Uh-huh.
So they can do more of the work. It's not like I was doing experiments and calculations and running the computer system and maintaining the X-ray equipment and, you know, basically.
Because there were just less people.
Yeah, less people. Yeah.
You attracted in other words, some work attracted people that maybe would have been with you in Salt Lake now, who are now with you here.
Yeah.
Or just because there was just a whole bunch of people in Berkeley at the university, let's say.
Some of both.
In the program.
Yeah, it's definitely easier to attract people that come to Berkeley.
Yeah, no, I would have said, so that maybe has had that advantage, too. Although, again, just being in a place like Berkeley, right, you may have maybe more students, you know,
right.
Just looking around for something like this.
Yeah, life. Yeah. So,
as you've expanded, you know, have you really kind of left off? I mean, do you get your hands wet, I guess is the right
I had a sabbatical visitor for the last 6 months. He left in June, and he and I did some things together.
Okay. Who was this? I mean, just for...
Bob Matthews.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I show students or postdocs specific techniques or things like that.
Yeah, and again, by asking you, by giving a lot of that up, I'm not suggesting that it's not a good, you know...
Oh, I definitely don't have a project that I'm working on.
There was an article in Science that it also included Charlie Zucker as, you know, were these labs getting out of hand? I mean, also like Leroy Hood and
mm-hmm.
you know, I think it's called the stupid title, Lifestyles of the Lab Styles of the Rich and Famous or something like that. Not rich, but, you know, well-funded.
Lab Styles, yeah.
I don't know if you ever saw this.
I saw that, yeah.
Okay, and of course I was impressed by the German man. I think he was the only, you know, non-American interview for the piece. He said, who cares if I'm not working at the bench anymore? Do you think they're paying me the salary that they pay me to use my hands instead of my mind or something like that? They hired me because I manage people well and I have some good ideas about it, or something like that. He was highly insulted that people might suggest that a large lab precluded him from, like, diddling around in the lab. And I don't have an opinion either way that, you know, you're supposed to always be a hands-on researching, you know, scientist. But I'm wondering if you have your own kind of that's a loss, or it's a good equilibrium you've reached, or the lab's getting too big or too small.
Oh, no. It's not too big. But definitely you lose something when you get away from the bench. Well, you lose a lot of things. And you lose an intuition for what really might be happening next. And you lose access to the data in a way that, you know, you can actually look at the subtleties and look at the results and just look at the results more critically or something.
Just the
carefully.
Sense that no matter who it is, the best graduate student, the best postdoc, they can't be your eyes for you or your hand. Right?
Exactly.
Completely they can't, right?
Yeah.
Is there something that's replaced? In other words, some advantages that are kind of godly, well, like perspective or, you know, that sort of thing in kind of distancing your... putting a little bit more distance between you and direct...
Well, you can try lots of things. You can follow a lot more ideas. You can... have other people who chase down, follow up specific things that are actually important that you would never be able to do by yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to work with people.
Sure. You know, you can't. Yeah. You know, Mendel, that's a nice idea, but it just doesn't work. Or even like, we keep using Barbara McClinic, but really, I mean, that's an idealized and romantic notion that just can't happen anymore, I don't think, because of the just... equipment, right? You just can't even maintain all this equipment yourself. Right?
Yeah.
You just can't even do that. Barbara McClintock style experiments without certain kinds of equipment anymore. So, do you think that? I mean, theoretical physicists, even kind of experimental physicists, you know, they can work alone, and other people whose mind, you know, who use their minds in a creative way, artists, movie critics, novelists. You talked about, you know, getting your writing done in Australia, right? You know, can be alone and get their work done. Do you like the fact that you almost by default have to work with other people? Even if it is kind of lonely sometimes when you're here at 3 a.m. by yourself, especially in the grad student phase, right?
Actually,
do you like that part
with graduate students in the lab, you know, it's much more lonely around here at 8 a.m. compared to 3 a.m.
Yeah,
you definitely can always find someone here at 3 a.m.
Right, but nobody's here at 8 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
You really in at 8 a.m. yourself?
Me? No.
No, okay.
Forget it.
Nobody's here at 8 a.m.
Well, you know, when I teach,
you have to at least
have a more coherent schedule.
The cooperation and collaboration is that you think a good, I mean, you are, as you said, you know, at least you are the opinion that you are, you know, pretty much what's the word? I don't want to use extrovert, introvert, but maybe that I will. You think of yourself more as an introvert than an extrovert. In a world where, I guess a lot of people are extroverts or forced to be. Or
mm-hmm, sure, yeah.
But do you like...
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. Still, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
and, you know, I'm facing the fact that my work, of course, doesn't get done without other people. I mean, it is based on cooperation. It's unsuccessful.
Oh, sure, it's really exciting. Yeah.
I don't know how to do that. I used to do dusty old books and stuff. You know,
yeah.
Everybody I wanted to talk to was dead. Now everybody is different. And I was just occurred to me that there's something that affects people's attitudes and the work they might do when they're in a situation where they're doing it with others. Compromise. There must be enough lot of compromise. I don't mean intellectually, or just about how things get done at what pace and that sort of thing. I don't know. What classes are you teaching here to kind of maybe finish up with the
protein chemistry and a new course called Introduction to Structural Biology for undergraduates.
It's kind of a lower class. I mean, or this is like once you get through some basic biology, this is a class, an elective they can take.
Yeah, it follows biochemistry.
Okay, so it's a requirement for some majors then?
Not in the first year. We're just going to try it this spring and see what happens.
But you expect again to get junior level people?
Juniors and seniors.
How many? How many are in a class?
Well, we're limiting it to 45 because it has a computer lab, but What I was told is there'd be several hundred that might be interested, so.
I don't need to smell water in there, I guess.
Yeah.
You say, you're willing to put in 10 hours of work in my life?
Right.
Do you have, I mean, is it something you came up with? I mean, how did the, how does this kind of a, I mean, obviously I can imagine the bureaucratic stuff about getting it approved, but I'm more interested in the genesis of it kind of intellectually or...
Structural biology is a new focus in the department here. Several new faculty have been hired in the last 2 or 3 years. Hillary Nelson, Susan Marcusi.
Who's the newest hire, right?
Well, actually, I'm the newest, but Tracy Handel is coming in June, so she was just hired this year.
And where is she? I mean, can you give a little bit of the just the pedigree or something? You know, I mean... or you, if you don't know, I mean...
Tracy did her graduate work at Caltech and did her postdoc with Bill DeGrotto at DuPont, okay. And is now at DuPont. She has a group there.
Oh, she has. So she's coming in a tenured
She's
level,
been
or?
Promoted. No, she's coming in as an assistant professor. Susan was with Buzz Baldwin as a graduate student, Bob Sauer as a postdoc, so Stanford, MIT.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary was with Bob Sauer and Aaron Klug.
And she came in at the assistant level, too.
Yeah.
And it's and the other one, Susan, also?
Yeah.
Okay, so you were the... and this, so this is an all-out kind of, you know, this is a real plan they have. I mean...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And definitely. Was it kind of step-by-step, I mean, or it was all planned? I mean, have you had now, have you participated in sort of the plan once you got here? And
well, in terms of resources, Tracy is the last person on board. We don't have any other FTEs, any other faculty positions mm-hmm. to offer. You know, her work is on NMR of mostly proteins, so structure of proteins in solution. Mm-hmm.
And Susan Marcus
protein
Susan
folding,
okay.
And Hillary would be protein DNA interactions.
So that's kind of covers, right, the area of you know, structural protein.
Yeah, I mean we're missing a computational person, mm-hmm. but it's hard to find the right sort of person.
They seem to be kind of like the cowboys now, the cowgirls of the world, right? They kind of hire themselves out for project sort of thing.
Yeah, maybe so.
I've come across indirectly a few of them, you know, by other interviews.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to, you know, they really are kind of jockeys. They come in and solve a problem, and they've been at 16 different places in the past 3 years.
I see. Yeah.
They get great consulting fees. That's why they're unemployed. They can do the consulting fee route.
This is an attempt to strengthen structural approaches on campus. Berkeley's been strong in biochemistry
since
the dawn of time, apparently. And you know, this is a new area of biochemistry. It's a growing area of the field, and so they raise the money to set up all these people.
And this is internal. This is university funds, I take it, and not like.
No, it's all external.
Okay, so this
not
is somebody
all,
giving
but
them
virtually all external. Okay. Markey Foundation.
And so they kind of the Markey Foundation.
Keck Foundation.
Them or by so you don't know the you know I know things like the Pew gives money to Rockefeller in a kind of a generic general sense. Mm-hmm. They give them money, right? That I mean maybe for specific projects, but they're mm-hmm. not given to labs. Okay.
Oh, no, this was for a specific proposal to
that
set up structural
university or
biology.
The campus wrote for.
It was probably two or three of the faculty here in the department.
Oh,
yeah,
who they were?
Koshlin, Thorner,
okay.
Glazer. I mean, I wrote a Markey grant with Marty Recksteiner at Oregon for a structural biology center that was funded year I left, actually.
Okay. Funded in the sense with an FTE, an academic teaching kind of thing, or just was a... You were asking for funding for space and equipment and that sort of thing.
Equipment, it was... We asked for $8 million
and got
$2.5 million. And
that's not bad, right?
I mean, oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, Berkeley got, I think, $8 million from the Markey Foundation.
For this whole... And so this included the cost of the renovations?
Yeah, the renovations and the equipment, and okay. It's all spent, basically. we're trying to raise more now because we would like to get more equipment.
More equipment, not more. And you feel that the four, I mean, these are four new positions, right? I mean, they're not, they didn't like end up losing a biochemist or a...
Yeah, they did. The positions have to come from the university.
Okay. And they wouldn't allow more to be created. They right. docked this whole right. division, I take it. They're not just the...
Right.
Which is kind of... Maybe we've been through this, but it's... Molecular and cell biology is what the whole thing's called, and then there are three...
No. Yeah, it's not really worth going okay. through the organization.
Well, actually, you know, but it's worth mentioning yeah. and making explicit because all this structural stuff, if you will...
Yeah, it was endorsed by the whole department in that right. sense, yeah.
Okay. Including these guys, you know, I mean, this whole department is... What's it called, then?
Molecular and cell biology.
And that's got the three... groups with the three chairs in it. Three very, you know, like powerful people. Like, I don't know how it works, but I think we use the word fiefdom.
Yeah. I mean, this is something actually that we tried to do in Utah.
Faculty groups or...
The department that I moved to had sort of gone downhill. And... what was done was to get co-chair people from within the university to take on the task of rebuilding the department, and specifically to emphasize structural biochemistry or physical biochemistry or at least biochemistry on campus. And so there were six open slots and two chairmen, and they had money to recruit people. And part of the reason I went to Salt Lake was the fact that, you know, who in their lifetime gets to be on the ground floor of a department? You can have a big influence. You can help hire, you know, I can help hire the other five people. You know, in principle, in the ideal world, you would get your friends and colleagues who you most want to work with to come and, you know, be in the department. And so it was... to me, an exciting opportunity to organize a place or help organize a place. That's certainly how Eugene was, the history of the Institute of Molecular Biology in Eugene was that way. Mm-hmm.